Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino. With cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Welcome everyone to Ness and Dorma, your chat about 80s and 90s football. We return for our latest float in the soothing waters of football for another time after spending a few episodes in the most recent edge of our time period, right up in the late 90s. But this episode, we're quantum leaping all the way back to the very beginning to talk about Aston Villa. That'll be coming up later on. I'm Lee, obviously, and joining me in this episode are Gary Naylor. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Lee. How are you?
Oh, very well. And also, Mike Gibbons is here. Hi, Mike.
Oh, boy. Just trying to do a quantum leap
there. Very good. Yes, I've got it. Mike got it, Mike. Guys. Don't worry. You can get in touch with us at Ness and Dorma Pod on the Twitter, or we can get in touch with me. You can actually get in touch with me directly through at Blood and Mud on Twitter, which is my rugby account, but that is basically me if you want to get hold of me. How do people get hold of you, Gary?
At Gary Naylor 999 on Twitter.
And should you want to, you know, make Mike feel better about that joke, how'd you get in touch with him?
At Mike W. Gibbons, if you want to critique my crap attempts at comedy.
We're on Acast, we're on Apple Podcasts, we're on anywhere you can find podcasts, really. If you put Ness and Dorma Football Podcast into Google, there'll be numerous services that we're on now that you can use your favourite one. We're also crucially on patreon.com/NessUndorma, which is where you can come and give us a bit of support so we can keep this ship afloating in these waters of nostalgia. Thanks to everyone who supports us already, but we've had quite a few people join up to support us in the past few weeks. I did make the point that we're actually ahead of time on our recording schedule, so we might put an episode out which is after when you signed up, but you signed up after we recorded as well. This does sound like Quantum Leap now, doesn't it? But basically, what I'm saying is you will definitely get to it. It's just that you may have signed up after we recorded, but before the release date. So don't worry.
Lee, are you podcasting here from inside the DeLorean car here?
Yeah, I wish. Well, there's a great documentary about that on BBC iPlayer at the minute, actually, the DeLorean, if you fancy.
A fantastic book called On a Clear Day You Can See General Motors. If you want to look at corporate dysfunctionality, John DeLorean's book is fantastic.
So there are two ways you can support us on patreon.com /NessUndorma. You can do a £5 friend of the club tier where you get a lovely mention on here. And the people we've had who've joined up for that are Mark Hinchcliffe, Barry Kelly, Josh Turnbull, Harry Taylor, Neil Kelly and Neil French. Thank you very much. It means a hell of a lot that we can keep this going, that you want to support us in that way. So, and we couldn't do it without you. So thank you very much indeed. We also have the £10 tier, which is for people who want to be kind of club ultra super members, who also get us having a bit of a go at describing what kind of 80s and 90s footballer, or how we imagine you would have fit into the 80s and 90s footballer world. So first of all, we've got Neville Wall. Now, what do we think about Neville Wall, Mike?
Well, I've written a little bio for him here. So I thought Neville Waugh would be a midfield schemer, one of those kind of guys, overlooked initially in England, who went to the North American Soccer League and made his name there with the New York Cosmos, doing all with Pelé and Giorgio Canali's hard running while they shook their hangovers off from the previous night at Studio 54. And yeah, emboldened by that, then he returned to England for a carousel around the Midlands clubs, you know, Wolves, West Brom, Coventry, Birmingham, six England B caps, and a reputation as a classy operator, but bemusingly overlooked for Bobby Robson's full England squad. That's Neville Waugh for me.
Well, there you go. I think Chinaglia and Pelé have done well getting out of Studio 54 with just a hangover. But
yeah. The thing with Neville is it's hard not to do word association. So I was thinking, right, don't do a fullback and don't do a Welsh international legendary goalkeeper.
Also, the £10 tier this time is Kevin Alexander. I've got 5'2" forward Kevin Alexander formed one of the league's most visually striking partnerships of the 90s at Stockport County with 6'7" Kevin Francis, known as the Kevs. They were fodder. They were fodder for fanzines and tabloid picture editors over a five-year period that they were together. Alexander then moved to Chesterfield and played with a man of average height, and therefore lost his passion for the game. And now, actually, is retired and has a mail-order cupcake business in Macclesfield.
I'm calling a VAR on that one, Lee, because I think that's actually true.
yeah. So thank you very much, Neville, and thank you very much, Kevin. It's really. I hope you. Well, let us know whether that matches you at all. Are you short, Kevin? I don't know. I'm sorry if you're not. Again, what I will say is we're catching up on a lot of having to look through people who signed up. So if we have missed anybody, please don't be frightened of shouting out via the Patreon messaging service, because you do get that access as a patron. You can message us directly on there. So thank you very much indeed. That's patreon.com/nessandorm if you fancy a bit of that. Okay, so we always start with a player of the pod, do we not, these days? And this time around, we've picked Manchester United, Everton, and many others, Ukrainian stroke Lithuanian stroke Russian stroke Soviet winger Andrei Kanchelskis. Who wants to start? Gary, why don't you give us some thoughts on Andrei Kanchelskis?
Well, I'll start with his full name, actually, which makes him sound like a character out of Chekhov who would walk into some country house and sigh and plonk themselves down, because his name is Andrei Tanasovich Kanchelskis. And one of the reasons I'm starting with that is because back in kind of 1990-1991, he was an extremely exotic creature. There weren't that many players, overseas players, you know, one hesitates to say British players because there's always been lots of Irish playing in English league, and of course any number of Scots really since the English league's founding. But I think there were only 7 or 8 players. In fact, I've got them here. He was one of only 13 non-British or Irish players to play on the opening weekend of the Premier League, along with Jan Stejskal,
Stejskal, yeah.
Stejskal, yeah. And then some more familiar names, Peter Schmeichel, Robert Wasika, Roland Nielsen, Eric Cantona, who remembers him, Hans Segers, John Jensen, Anders Limpar, Gunnar Haller, Craig Forrest, Michel Vonk, and Ronnie Rosenthal. But you know, each of those you could kind of place, you know, there were the efficient Moneyball Scandinavians, there was the Gaelic shrugging Eric Cantona, there was Ronnie Rosenthal with his coat hanger shoulders. But Kanchelskis was just this exotic creature who was Russian, and we all called them Russians, no matter where in the Russian Empire they came from. His background was Ukrainian, as many Russian footballers of the 70s and 80s were. But there he I won't say literally exploded onto the scene, because that sets me up for private eye, but he exploded into sort of football consciousness because he had this kind of extreme pace and this running style, slightly sort of crabbed running style. And he couldn't really see where it came from, because physically, you know, he was no Usain Bolt. He wasn't some giant of a man or obvious kind of sprinter who was gliding over the ground. He just had this extraordinary ability to sort of kick the ball past a fullback. And no matter where the ball ended up, he would get on the end of it. And he was so lightning quick. He also had a very decent shoulder drop, so he could cut inside and outside. And I think he was an early reverse winger in some ways, and he cut inside and shot for goal. And I think we might come to it a little later. I hadn't seen so many of these before, although we're going to come to one in the second part of the pod, of a wide player who provided a genuine goal threat in that he would come inside and shoot. Previously, wide players had been more like Dave Thomas, and we've got an interview with Dave Thomas on Ness and Dormer back there in the archive, who would usually stay wide and look to hit the byline and cross the ball into a centre forward. And Kanchelskis wasn't like that. He was a man who cut inside and shot for goal. But the kind of main early thoughts of Kanchelskis is that we all sort of sat up and took notice and thought, you know, what is this? This is a kind of new kind of player. He was a wild card. And then the rumours started circulating, of course, about his past, and all kinds of rumours about his service in the Soviet army and all of this kind of stuff. And it was in the early days when we were becoming familiar with the fact that the breakup of the Soviet Union had led to some, shall we say, interesting characters to assume power and money. And when it comes to entourages and difficult agents, well, Andrei Kanchelskis could show Paul Pogba a thing or two. I'll just say that. We'll come to that later on. So that's kind of my initial thoughts on Kanchelskis that we can explore, is his exotic otherness.
That point about where he came from, Gary, is an interesting one, because, and Mike, you may know more about this as a United man. He was signed from Shakhtar Donetsk for $650,000 in 1991, which was not a small amount of money, and apparently from a video. So the story goes. Have you heard that one?
Yeah, it's from an under-21s game, I think, that he was playing for the USSR. And he was recommended to Ferguson by Rune Hauger, apparently, who was the agent who was famous. I'm not saying there's any involvement in this in the Kanchelskis transfer, but he was involved, you know, with the George Graham, you know, the whole Bungs thing about sort of 4 years later. And yeah, coming out of the Soviet Union, which was still limping on as an entity until the end of 1991. So Kanchelskis signed in the March of 91. Obviously no transfer windows then. So a complete unknown, really. And arrived at Old Trafford at the end of the 1991 season, just before the United won the European Cup Winners' Cup, actually. And it was after they won that trophy, Ferguson said to his coaches, you know, I'm going to raise the stakes. You know, this club has to start winning the league. So that's what Kanchelskis walked into, really. And Gary makes the point about his pace and his directness. And I was thinking this morning, actually, how good he would be in football now, Kanchelskis. He seems quite futuristic, I think, in the way he plays here. And I think he's the difference between a winger that can go past someone and get a yard to get a cross in, and one that can just beat you and cut straight in on goal. I mean, he's so quick. He must have been the quickest player in the league at the time. I can't think of one that would have been quicker. Possibly, I'm sure he was quicker than Giggs, who was maybe the only other quickest player at United. But
The only one that I've seen, I mean, I saw Kanchelskis live quite a few times for Everton, and he was, it's impossible to say, and you know, someone's going to come out and say that they, you know, that the quickest player in football is Phil Jagielka, I think, 1 year when they timed him with GPS, which gives my opinion.
It was always Keith Curl in this period, wasn't it?
Yeah, the accuracy of such matters. But he looked yards quicker than anybody else on the field. I mean, not, you know, he was like an international athlete on a school's sports day. He was that much quicker than anybody else. The only player I've seen who possibly was as quick as Kanchelskis was, and I think we talked about him a pod or two ago was the early iteration of Nicolas Anelka at Arsenal, who could just run away from defenders and find himself in 5 yards of space in the penalty box, having started a run on the halfway line. He's the only one. I think he was quicker than Giggs. He was more explosive as a runner. And it came from nowhere because, you know, Giggs glides and you can see the natural athlete that's in Giggs. Kanchelskis was just this kind of middleweight boxer who could run extremely quickly and then finish with a resting heart rate of about 35.
He had that amazing, that thing I always find amazing about players at that level of pace, who run without moving their arms.
Yeah.
He kind of used to run with the ball with his elbows slightly stuck out, didn't he, and his arms dangling down. But moving like a pace at which you've never seen, you know, this, which is with the ball as well, which is absolutely remarkable. And he didn't have, this is going to sound stupid, but he didn't have obvious dribbling ability. Or am I being, is that unfair? Because he just seemed to go incredibly quick with a few touches of the ball, and the pace did most of it. I might be doing him down a bit here, but Mike, what do you think?
Well, I think that's fair. I mean, I think it's because he knew he was quicker than Peter. It's that tap and go thing, isn't it? And,
why do you need a step over when I can just do this?
Yeah, and it's, you know, it would almost be like the little roadrunner cloud of dust behind him, and, you know, he'd just be gone. But, I mean, what that pace gave United was it, off both wings then, they had him and Giggs, and it helped turn them into this great quick counter-attacking side. And one of the great calling cards of those early Fergie teams was the ability to win the ball back and then just get it in the net within, say, 10 seconds. I mean, he scored one of the most revered and iconic goals in United's history. It's in the 3-1 game with Norwich in April of 93, where United go to Carrow Road and win 3-1. And they were going sort of nose-to-nose with Norwich and Villa for the title then as well. And it's a sort of four-pass move from their own six-yard area that ends up with Kanchelskis going around the goalkeeper and rolling it in, and he was part of all that. I mean, as a player, it's at United, he's a real cult hero, Kanchelskis. I mean, I think the nearest equivalent I can think to for such a short time, because he was at United for 4 seasons, and if you think about that short amount of time, but the impact and the long tail in terms of the legacy, it's probably Jaap Stam is the nearest one I could think of, because, you know, he was there for 3 seasons, but he's involved in so much that's so fondly remembered. Kanchelskis, obviously, you know, United's first title for 26 years, the club's first double. So he was a key part of this whole, you know, I guess revolution that took place in those early Premier League.
I think that's why he was there a lot less time than the presence of him at United in my mind suggests. And I think that plays into what you just said, because looking back at this, I kind of knew the numbers, but he was like, realistically, from when he signed and then when he actually came into the team, it was 3 years, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean,
it's a solid presence. And you think, God, was that all it was? Because he was just, like you said, so hugely associated with the club in that period. And seems like he should have stayed longer. I mean, my best mate is a huge United fan, season ticket and everything. And he was the full United top and furry Soviet hat thing. He wore that for about 2 years because he just loved him. And I think, yeah, it's like he should have stayed longer, but he didn't. But in a way, that makes it almost better. I don't know.
Yeah, the 92-93 season, he wasn't in the team that much, actually. So Sharp played more than him. So they rotated Sharp, Giggs and Kanchelskis.
And he was fined for not refusing to play for the reserves, wasn't he, during that period? You know, there were like rumblings of what was to come quite early when you look at it now. That when Sharp got fit again and then Ferguson said, you've got to play in the reserves, he said, I'm not. So he fined Kanchelskis. Sorry, Mike.
Yeah, I mean, there's a point. His last 2 seasons, I mean, he was so good in those 2 years. I mean, you couldn't really leave him out at that point. I mean, I imagine an Oldham fan must hate him. I mean, the amount of times he scored against Oldham. I mean, there's one goal he scores. It's in the Cup semi-final replay where he drifts across the face of the area and bangs it back into the top corner with his left foot. It's an absurd goal. It really is. And
it's not as absurd as Brian Robson scoring with his balls, but yeah, it is. It's
yeah. And he's got so many of those goals where he just streaks. So it's a famous one against QPR, actually. It's in the 92-93 season where Schmeichel hurls the ball to him like a baseball pitcher, sort of 50 yards. I think Clive Tilsley's doing the commentary and he says, oh, airmail to Kanchelskis. And they just puts him straight through on goal. And it seemed like, you know, Schmeichel was the only keeper who had that kind of throw in the league. And it just, it became this incredible weapon for United to break on teams. You know, down either wing with Giggs or Kanchelskis. And he was scoring, you know, double figures in those seasons as well. He was, he was such a threat.
Go on, Gary.
Well, when you say about his short career at Manchester United, his career was even shorter at Everton, where he only played one full season. He scored 16 goals. But he's revered equally at Everton, where in a poll to find, you know, the most iconic player or favourite player of Premier League era, he came in third behind, I think, Duncan Ferguson and Tim Cahill. And when you think he only played one season there, albeit he did score two goals at Anfield. But
that,
you know,
helps,
he was just,
doesn't it?
Yeah. It does help. I think they were in the Kop end as well, which is even sweeter. He was just this force of nature there, and you're right, he didn't really have a trick. And there was a time when Everton had Anders Limpar on one side of the field and Andrei Kanchelskis on the other. You can see why it was exciting to be an Everton fan in matches where both of them turned out. And I don't know if you recall that kind of grainy black and white thing that Paul Whitehouse and Harry Enfield did with Charlie as the captain of a kind of, you know, 1920s Arsenal team playing against 1980s Liverpool. But there's one point in which they pass the ball to their tricky winger and he's just moving it with his foot from one side to the other, to the other, to the other. And that was Anders Limpar, because Anders Limpar had his tricks and he would do that. Whereas on the other side, Kanchelskis, as you say, would either get the ball from a goalkeeper or, I hesitate to say long passes because your margin for error was enormous. You just had to boot the ball into the opposition half, really. And then he would run onto it and he would either kick the ball into the space himself and run and catch up with it, or he'd have a teammate do so. And I think you're right, Lee. I mean, what he would be like today would be just horrific, because the high press, he would just murder like two Jamie Vardys at once. And with VAR, you wouldn't be able to touch him. You'd be off for a dog so if you got him outside the box, and you'd be given a penalty if you got him inside the box. So he really would be undoubtedly a footballer you could pick up from the 1980s, do almost nothing with, maybe a little bit of conditioning if necessary, just put him into the football of 2021 and he would fit in and he would be a terror and would be a sort of £40-50 million player today. And he was just so exciting to watch because you never really knew what you were going to get, because if you didn't, I mean, he wasn't tracking back and he wasn't being disciplined, he wasn't covering his man and supporting the fullback and everything, and I think that played a part in his transfer from Manchester United. But for the kind of club that Everton were, which was a mid-table club looking to get into the top sort of five or six, he was just so exciting and a real game changer. I'd say on his day, he was just completely unplayable. And you could see the fear in defenders' eyes when Kanchelskis was up against you. And I don't want to labour this point too much, but we didn't really know where it was coming from, because we didn't know much about Russians. We kind of had, because he had a bit of a look of Sergei Bubka about him, and Bubka, the famous pole vaulter, had some outrageous sprint time on the run up to the pole vault, which is where he generated the momentum that flung him 6.2 meters over the bar or whatever. So, and there was Valery Bortsov, wasn't there, 1972 Olympics. There is a kind of tradition of Soviet sprinting, but he would just generate this pace from nothing and then run forward and kick the ball in the net. The other thing about Kanchelskis, which we haven't mentioned so much, is I don't think Pat Nevin and Anders Limpar headed the ball twice in their entire careers, but Kanchelskis was a fierce header of a football. you know, get the ball to him in the air, and he was getting across his man and getting his header in. And that was another dimension to his game. Yeah, he was his hero status at both Old Trafford and at Goodison are not the products of mythology. They're products of people who were there and saw him and wore the T-shirt and indeed the Soviet hat.
Mike, you mentioned that point about his move to Everton, Gary, you talked about, and Mike, you talked about his last season. He was obvious, didn't he? He scored like 16 goals or something up to Christmas in 94-95, didn't he? And then he had that weird, well, they think it was an appendix, but he got a mystery stomach complaint that nobody could diagnose, and it was a kind of beginning of the end, really. But the question I was going to ask is, how did his lack of appearance in that second half of 94-95 directly contribute to Blackburn winning ahead of United, do you think?
Well, it didn't help. I mean, there was one probably more significant absentee, I think, for the second half of the 94-95 season that probably made a bigger dip. But yeah, I mean, I think it was a hernia that put him out at the very end of the season. So he missed the cup final as well, where United lost to Everton. But he was the club's top scorer that season. You know, think of that off the wing as well. And there was a game before Christmas at Ewood Park where United beat Blackburn 4-2, and he basically turned that game around on his own. It was a real showcase of just how devastating he could be. A few weeks after that, he got a hat-trick against Man City, you know, much like, you know, the hat-trick at the Cop, the two goals at the Cop end. That you know, reserves a lot of goodwill in the bank for you with the fans. But it's interesting, Ferguson's first autobiography, Manager My Life, he notes a change in Kanchelskis in that season. I think he says, oh, what happened to the, you know, the nice young boy that used to come in with a smile on his face every day? You know, there was something about him that had changed. There was problems with his agents. Ferguson's alleged that he was offered a bribe to sell him. So there was all kinds of stuff going on, but there's all kinds of rumours about that I'm not going to air here, just in case we get in any bother.
We haven't got enough time. It'll take about 2 hours to get to.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, and it was kind of on his way, and also because I guess great teams, they move in 3-4 year cycles, don't they? That United were about to change, and that summer he left, Mark Hughes left, and Ince left, and then it's, you know, the kids and the well-worn story. And all of that. So his career kind of petered out a bit at the end of 94-95. So he never really got the goodbye with the United fans that his performances would have merited, I think.
Yeah. And the thing is, his exit from Everton was similar, wasn't it, Gary? That suddenly he just seemed to, his head drifted away, and then it was very difficult to pull him back.
Well, he was kind of high maintenance. We know that. And it was at a time when, with the breakup of the Soviet Union, shall we say, business norms were yet to be established. Let's put it like that. So, so how one conducted business with those from the old Soviet Union or connections into the emerging republics and the politicians and oligarchs and so on that still, you know, play a big part at Everton, amongst other places, but obviously elsewhere in football. And Kanchelskis appeared to be something of a pawn in these matters. And, you know, there was talk about sort of various release clauses where you paid a transfer fee, but then there were additional fees to be paid both to the player and to the agent, and, you know, how much of it actually would go to the player as opposed to the people around the player remains to be seen. And Kanchelskis, you know, maybe this is unfair because he's built a life outside or after his playing career as a football manager. And his son, who I served in the shop where I'm about to go and work this afternoon, he's a football agent himself. But he seemed a kind of innocent abroad. You know, he was this it's a whirling dervish on the field. He wasn't a sophisticated player on the field. He didn't have the loquacious presence of a Thierry Henry or the stumbling, charming, charismatic English of Gianfranco Zola. He did do some interviews in a kind of stumbling English, but you never really got to know the man. But what you did get to know were the rumours and the stories. And of course, nature abhors a vacuum. So where you don't find out who this cult status player is, then in come all the stories and the tales, and there were tales of dressing room punch-ups and stuff like this, and run-ins with managers. But he was universally liked by fans, and many, many players speak highly of him and enjoyed his company and his presence. So in some ways, he seemed rather an unworldly figure in a world in which being unworldly was quite a good thing to be, because if you were worldly in that world, if that makes sense, then you were going to end up in some strange places. And indeed, you know, to be deadly serious, people who were associated with Kanchelskis were actually sort of assassinated at football matches. You know how associated they were and how loose that association is, but you don't need to go far online when you're looking at the people who were around Kanchelskis to find some pretty gruesome stuff, and say not just in money, in terms of assaults on the person. So, you know, he got through that, and to his credit, but it kind of shows, I think, in some ways in how he was unsettled at clubs. And for a man of that talent, even at that time, to you know, the most appearances he had at any club, according to the irrefutable source of Wikipedia, is 123 games he played at Manchester United, 3 full seasons, as we mentioned, just 52 at Everton, Fiorentina 26, Rangers 76, and then some dribs and drabs at the magnificently named Saturn Moscow Oblast there. But he never established a real career at a club, and you know that may be due to the noises off, wanting to have another slice of the cake that was Kanchelskis' talent and what that would bring in terms of monetary advancement.
Yeah, talking about him not settling in and trying to settle in, there was an interview he talked about the friend that he became friends or sort of friends with Brian Robson, and because their dads were both lorry drivers, they bonded over that when they found that, or he bonded with Brian Robson over that. And it seems that Brian Robson took him under his wing a bit. And he said, but get this. I got on with Robson. He'd taken me to his house. Okay, I understand that. And to Chester races. Yeah, I get that. And to a Paul Simon concert. Imagine that, yeah. Graceland, and still crazy after all these years while Robson and Kanchelskis are sat there.
Robson doing vodka shots with a Russian at Chester races. Is it?
Oh, that, I can definitely see that picture. That picture I can see. Yeah. It's the Paul Simon concert I'm struggling with.
Yeah.
Well, I'd go to that, certainly with those two. I'd definitely go to a Paul Simon.
I just wouldn't remember it.
So anything else on Andrei Kanchelskis? Mike, anything you want to finish saying, conclusion?
I guess around his career, you know, he went to Fiorentina, didn't he, after Everton. I remember that happening quite suddenly. You know, kind of within the space of a few days, he was gone and it didn't work out. I think he has a bit of a, not quite the same level as Everton and United, but he has a bit of a cult status at Rangers as well for the 4 years he was there, because he sort of changed from being this, direct pacer. I think a bit of his pace had gone by then, but he did loads of innovative bits of skill that used to crop up on Soccer AM and things. So there's one time he ran up to a fullback and he stood on the ball with both feet. So he was standing on top of it. And then he put his his hand over the top of his eyes like a sailor looking for port, you know, to see where the goal was. And that got, you know, a big standing ovation. There was one as well where he squared up a fullback and then he jumped and did a full 360 pirouette before trying to knock the ball past him. And basically fell over. So, yeah, I think he was, I don't know, at the end of his career, he was, yeah, he was trying to do those highlights reel things where, you know, you're trying to be remembered. And just touch on his international career a bit as well, actually, because when he started playing for the Soviet Union, as we said earlier, it was just about to start to fragment. So obviously that fragmentation meant their international side wasn't strong as more, and, you know, and it split into, you know, Ukraine and Lithuania and Latvia and other nations. So yeah, Kanchelskis is a Ukrainian, but his mother is Russian and his dad is Lithuanian, or I might have that the wrong way around. But he carried on playing for Russia after the breakup, but they didn't really. I mean, they were knocked out in the first round of the two European championships he played in. He led a player boycott of the Russia squad at the 94 World Cup when he was absolutely in his pomp. And he didn't go to that World Cup. So, he doesn't really have an international career to match his club one, I guess. But, from those early years of the Premier League particularly, I think, he's a very sort of cult player, I think. He's involved in so many, you know, notable goals and moments, I think. And I think the way he played makes him stand out as well. It did feel like he was on fast forward compared to, you know, a lot of other wingers in the league. And then, you know, later on, I mean, we spoke about this on one of the other pods, but Mark Overmars and Anelka and Arsenal would take that on, you know, a level even further in 97-98. But very, very fondly remembered player, and you know, really entertaining to watch.
The last point I'll make about that, you said about that move to Fiorentina happened in a matter of days, but Joe Royle, when he was interviewed, said it had actually been building up for quite some time, because one of the reasons why Kanchelskis kind of head went that second half of the Everton season was that he knew the Italians were interested.
Oh, right.
So I think there was a bit of drip of it, to him at least anyway, that contributed. And he had a few niggling injuries in that second season, didn't he, Gary? But I think it all plays into, completely agree, it was wonderful to have him around, but all plays into the fact that he was maybe, how much better could he have been in some ways if he hadn't had this constant drip of what Gary mentioned about this, not so much an entourage, but certainly people around him who were trying to get something via his career, it sounds like. Which is a shame, really, because he probably wouldn't have stuck it out at United, would he? Because Ferguson made a decision to make changes. And if you think about Beckham, very, very different right-sided player to Kanchelskis. It was a complete shift, wasn't it? I mean, I will make the point that everyone's very wise in cool washes their history of football in this, because everybody thought that Ferguson was bonkers. You know, it says, that thing about what Alan Hansen said and laughs about it. So that's what everybody thought.
Yeah.
So this is not a kind of look how stupid Hansen is. It's like, no, we were all completely stupid compared to Ferguson, funnily enough.
Yeah, and I will just say about his agents, actually. I mean, he was a very young lad when he would have signed in with the people that were representing this. And you see this in so many fields, don't you, in, you know, in music.
Every English band in the 60s, for example.
Yeah, but it's, you know, you never really know until you're signed in with someone, you know, how it's going to play and what these people are like. And once you're in, you know, you're legally bound and, you know, you're tied to them then.
And according to rumours, you're bound by more than legality by some of these people that we're talking about. So
I mean, I think there's a temptation to think maybe he was naive or a bit, you know, a bit daft to get involved with some of the people here. But I don't know. I would give, you know, I'd be tempted to give some people a lot of leeway on that kind of thing, because often the full horror of what people are like when they, you know, when they turn on you over money and things like that, doesn't become fully apparent until a lot long after you've, you know, you've inked the paper.
Yeah, I mean, he was lucky and unlucky. He was lucky in that had he been born 10 years earlier, we might only have seen him at World Cups. He might have been like a comet, you know, that came across every 4 years because he would have played behind the, here's the cliche, Iron Curtain. But he was unlucky in that he came to prominence at a time when the Soviet Union was a, you know, let's not mince words about it, it was a failed state. And into that vacuum rushed the characters who always rush into failed states. And they often have unsavory approaches to business, approaches to life, certainly approaches to personal relationships. And Kanchelskis was no mug, but he was a young man. He was kind of 22 or something like that.
An authoritarian regime previously as well, Gary. Yeah. I mean, you did what you were told in that regime.
You did what you were told, and I don't think any. You read a lot of stories, some of which are substantiated, some of which remain as rumours. And they've always been there around the people who were hanging on to Kanchelskis. But I don't think anybody points a finger at the man himself and says he bears any opprobrium with this. And had he been born 10 years later, then some of the structures that have come forward to do with registration of agents by UEFA and things like that would have done a lot better job in terms of protecting Kanchelskis from some of those winds that circled him. But ultimately, it's a bit like, I talk a lot about this when it comes to art, when it comes to culture and stuff like that. If we're constantly looking at the person and we're looking at the people around the person and we ignore the art and we ignore what they did, then the world becomes a very bleak place. It becomes terribly black and white and it becomes an environment in which you don't wish to move. And I think sometimes you've just got to look at the art. And, I'll finish on this point. I came home a couple of years ago and said to my elder boy, God, I served Andrei Kanchelskis's son today at work. Couldn't believe it. He showed me his ID card for buying booze. And I said, oh, Kanchelskis, there's a famous name. And it was his girlfriend who turned around and said, yeah, he's his son. I said, really? And of course you look then and you see the face, and we had a chat for 5 minutes or so, partly because his son is a big Everton fan, because he grew up at a time when Kanchelskis was at Everton, and he still goes back and watches Everton at Goodison. But Jesper said to me, who was he? I never heard of him, Kanchelskis. And so we got out the highlights reel, and he just sort of sat there watching it, saying, how come I don't know this person? How come I don't know this player with these extraordinary goals? And I come back to that point, if you're going to look at a Picasso or a Modigliani or any, Elvis Presley and judge them by the people who were around them and judge them by what existed outside their art, then you're missing so much more. And no matter what the people say about Andrei Kanchelskis and what there is in terms of rumours and say the undoubted hideous things that went around that happened either close to him or a knight's move away in which, as I say, he is blameless. Come back to the goals, come back to the play, come back to Evertonians sitting around a pub saying, I tell you what, that Kanchelskis can play. And there'll be some Manchester United fans at a table opposite and they'll come across and they'll say, he could play for us too. There aren't many players who could unite those two factions, but Kanchelskis could.
And Rangers fans just, say, do you remember that time he stood on the ball and pretended to look for the goal?
Sorry, he's actually, just to end on one thing, actually, he's actually a quiz question answer to one of the great football quiz questions, which is he's the only player that's ever scored in a Glasgow derby, a Merseyside derby and a Manchester derby. So I can't imagine that will ever be equaled, but you never know.
So there you go. Andrei Kanchelskis, I hope you enjoyed that little rumble through our memories of him and thoughts around everything to do with him. If you've got something you'd like us to chat about as a player of the pod, then please do get in touch. We'd be happy to take nominations. So that's that part done. So we move on now to our main discussion, which will probably go into two parts because there's a lot to talk about, knowing us, which is Aston Villa's 1980-82 sort of league and European Cup triumphs. Before we get into that, there's probably something to talk about Villa and Birmingham, Gary, is there, and the history and everything?
I recall a quote, and it's an uncharacteristically ungenerous or mean quote from the vast archive that is the Tony Benn diaries, and they're a tremendous read, and they're full of warmth and opinion. As I say, and in the main, generosity even to political opponents. But there's a spike in one of the diaries where he says, "Never liked Birmingham. It's got no history." Now, Tony Benn was a working class romantic. He wasn't working class himself, but he wasn't aristocratic either. He got his peerage from his father being elevated to the peerage just before, I think, or during the Second World War, can't remember. But he romanticized working class life. And so to him, history was kind of the chapels and the mines of South Wales, or the march from Jarrow in the northeast, or the dockyards of Glasgow, the shipbuilding of Newcastle and Belfast, or and that sort of thing. And he said, you know, Birmingham is just a collection of factories that people went there to work in the factories, and they, you know, the heavy engineering and the Industrial Revolution, and, you know, all of those things that we learned about at school with Bessemer processes for iron and so on. Now, I mean, I have a kind of sympathy to some extent with that view. But when you go to Birmingham, it's a strange kind of sprawling place. And, you know, I've been many times on the motorbike to Birmingham, and, you know, you're not, unlike other cities, you're never quite sure when you're in Birmingham and you're not in Birmingham, because
it fails the can you draw it test.
Yeah, it definitely does. And as a city centre, it doesn't have a river that runs through it. It has any number of canals, more miles of canals than Venice. And parts of Birmingham are absolutely beautiful. You know, Edgbaston is beautiful, Bourneville, the kind of model city, built by the Quakers at Cadbury, there is a fantastic place to go and to walk around. But what Birmingham does have, it has this fantastic, and it's some of it is still there, that the Luftwaffe and the planners didn't get to. It has this wonderful kind of Victorian sort of architecture and Victorian feel to it, in the way that Glasgow does and parts of Manchester. It's a city, I think, of places rather than a city of kind of geography, if you like. And one of those places is Villa Park, often called Archibald Leach's crowning glory, the architect of many football grounds around England and Scotland. And whenever you go to Villa Park, the only other ground that has a presence like it was the old Highbury. So it might be the last one left. And even though it's been redeveloped now, and you don't quite get that sense of majesty. Yes, I'm betting without Ibrox, because I've never been to Ibrox, so that may have this presence as well. But it's the kind of, it's the red brick, it's the confidence. You know, it's been called the St. Pancras of football, because it's built almost like a kind of cathedral. It's built to last for not decades, but for centuries. And it says something about Villa. It lends Aston Villa a kind of authority that it always enjoyed, even though in the period just before the one that we're talking about, Villa had dipped even to the third level of English football. But I think partly because of its history, but also because of this presence of a ground, you know, hosted more semi-finals than any other football ground, FA Cup semi-finals than any other football ground in England. Villa always had this kind of cachet, this weight, and therefore the kind of shock that Leicester City winning the Premier League brought, it wasn't quite that same shock when you look back to Villa winning the title in 1980-81. But if you look at it in a purely football terms, it probably was as much of a shock. They wouldn't have started out at 5,000-1 for the title, but they probably have started at 500-1 for the title, or maybe in those days more like 100-1. But I think that context of Villa having this kind of historical and physical presence on the map of English football, it both lends, a context to what we're going to talk about, but it also substantiates what we're going to talk about. There was something right about Villa winning a title. And, you know, I wouldn't want to be born in 1963 and live on to whatever age I live on to and not have Villa win either a First Division or a Premier League title. And I'm pleased that they did.
Your point about Villa Park's a good one, actually, because of that semi-final thing. And when people talk about great terraces, I don't think the Holt End comes up enough in conversations. It tends to be dominated by the Kop and Stretford End and everything else, really. But the my dad was a truck driver. Maybe I could have gone to a Paul Simon concert but when I was on school holidays, my parents got divorced when I was 11, and when I was on school holidays, I'd go and stay with my dad and stuff, and I'd actually go on in the wagon with him when he worked for a company that had a just-in-time contract with Ford. So we would go from St. Helens in the north, where he was living at the time, and go to London a lot, and basically, and down to Dagenham and stuff. Anyway, what I'm trying to say, we used to go down the M6, and I remember my dad pointing out to me that you could see Villa Park from the M6, that particular part of the M6. If you're going south, you look to your right, and you could see that that sort of triangle, claret and blue badge on the stand. And how incredibly excited it was, and I would look for it every single time we went past. Oh, God, there's Villa Park. I've never been to Villa Park, as it goes, to watch a game. But, yeah, it was a kind of visceral excitement as a 13-year-old in 1989 to see that ground. And it was literally, you know, a very long way away, but I could make out that badge. And how exciting that was because of all that history, which I've never really thought about until you just said that, Gary. Yeah.
Well, the first time I went to Villa Park was in 1989. It was for the semi-final, Everton against Norwich, where, you know, the grim events at Hillsborough overtook that match. But due to coaches breaking down on the motorway and my dad and my brother having our tickets, me and my other brother come from London, and my dad and my youngest brother came from Liverpool, we were late getting in. Well, we weren't late, but we arrived, we got through the turnstiles 3:05. And I remember walking up these steps, and the steps were going on and on and on and on, and then came out at the top of the Holt End. And I've never been on a terrace as big as that, because Goodison doesn't have big terraces. And, you know, the other grounds that I've been to, London grounds, or I've been to plenty outside London grounds, didn't have a terrace that had that kind of sheer majesty in terms of its size. And yeah, you know, I don't know what its capacity is, and I've never been to Anfield, but the Kop can't be much bigger than the Holt End, because if it was much bigger than the Holt End, it would be in the clouds.
Yeah, so, and I suppose we come into this season, and I'll talk about, we'll go back a little bit in a minute, but we come into the season and you talk about the history and how everything looms large with Villa, with them having not won a championship for 71 years. And actually, Birmingham is Britain, England's, sorry, second largest city. The point you make about how many people move there, huge, you know, forefront of the immigrant population and throughout history, really, but particularly since the 50s. And yet, not a great record of footballing success. Well, despite all of its advantages, you could argue. Go on, Mike.
Yeah, so Villa, they're the biggest club in an enormous industrial area in England. And very early on in the Football League, actually, they were the most successful club in England. I think through the 1890s, I think they won, like, you know, five titles and stuff. And around the, you know, the turn of the century, they were probably the biggest club in England. And so that lends the club a stature, I think, along with, you know, everything you've said about Villa Park. I think Villa Park is very iconic in English football, because there'll be a lot of fans who their club will have just had the amazing day out there in the semi-final, where you secure your passage to Wembley. You know, you get your big day out at the cup final, and it's I've always thought it's an incredibly atmospheric ground, Villa Park. I don't know what it is about the acoustics there. And obviously you've got the whole thing of the occasions of semi-finals there as well. I mean, United have won a few, you know, enormous semi-finals there, two against Arsenal in particular, actually, one in 83, and then the famous one in 99 with the, you know, the Ryan Giggs goal in extra time. But, they have a standing in the game, though, and did, you know, approaching this season that we're going to talk about, that there was a grandeur to the club in the same way that I think, like, you know, West Ham and Tottenham have, but where it isn't so much backed up by recent results, but, you know, there is something different about them to other clubs that aren't winning, you know, leagues and trophies. I think
I'm still a bit pissed off that semi-finals aren't played at Villa Park. Oh. That probably says about my age. It leaves me completely cold that semi-finals just are played at Wembley as well now. There was something incredibly unique about another ground, another club lending you their ground for such a game, you know.
It was the most exciting thing to be going to another club's ground to see your team play against a third party. Was just so exciting. It was a unique experience. Semi-finals day is in April, so the sun was usually shining. I remember the sun shining very hard on Villa Park when in 89, a glorious day. And to go to Wembley, you know, Wembley is for the final, but Wembley also has an element of artifice to it. You know, it's Tarby's Cup final bar and all of this. There's a showbiz element to Wembley. And it was a hideous ground before it was redeveloped. And it's not very nice now. It was so much better when you go to a semi-final at a neutral venue, because you go in, you'd be wide-eyed because all the colours were different, and you'd look at the kind of names on the bars and you know, if there were any plaques around and this kind of stuff. It was just an absolute delight that's been swiped away from us so they can get 30,000 more in at Wembley and help pay off the debt of... you know, how many hundreds upon hundreds of millions of pounds were spent on a ground that is about as soulless as a shopping centre off the A52 or whatever.
Well, that was our old men yell at cloud moment there. So that's that out of the way.
Well, if young men knew what it was like, I think they would say the same thing.
Yes, you would.
The tragedy of it is that they haven't done... They haven't gone back to it. You know, they haven't gone back to England playing internationals around the country as well, which everyone received with the same sense of, you know, isn't this exciting and different? And, you know, the atmospheres were different and so on. But no, it's bloody Wembley. It's the
industrial estate in northwest London.
Oh, just don't. Awful. Don't get me started.
So that's the kind of long history of Birmingham and our recollections of Villa Park, which was actually a nice diversion. But I suppose more recently, just before this, or in the 5 years before this season happened, one of the key things that happened was that Ron Saunders took over in 1974 in this club. And in a way, when you look at it, kind of, in my mind, invented Moneyball, but in football in 1975, and went and built this team over a period that didn't cost a huge amount of money, but yet returned a great deal of value, if you're going to put it in those terms. Is that fair, Gary?
Yeah, I think it is fair. You know, they were an extraordinary blend of players, and we're going to look at them individually, and we'll obviously look at them as a team. But he only used 14 in this season, and he just had this ability to take players that perhaps other managers had either rejected or hadn't quite seen. And I mean, I think this was also the case of international managers, because they were abysmally served by international selections. I might have a few strong words about that later. But, you know, Ron Saunders himself was an extraordinary character. He was known as a disciplinarian, and he was as grim-faced as you could imagine was Ron. He spoke a little bit like Marcelo Bielsa does now, sort of reluctantly and downwards. He was very unforthcoming, if that's the right word. But by all accounts, he had the driest and wickedest of senses of humour. So, you know, he was in some ways a kind of counter stereotype. He was a non-loquacious scouser, but you could see that there was a hard edge to him. He'd been round the block as a journeyman player, and, you know, he, just looking at the teams he played for, three appearances for Everton, and then the splendidly named Tonbridge Angels. You know,
yeah, I spotted that as well. Yeah.
Take that, Anaheim. Yeah. And then Gillingham, Portsmouth, Watford and Charlton Athletic there. And then as a manager, you know, a similar sort of set of clubs in some ways, Yeovil, Oxford, Norwich, and he gets a gig for a year at Manchester City. I think every manager in the 70s had a go at Manchester City. And then he goes to Villa for his glory time, and then we'll come to the walk across the city to the Blues of Birmingham, and then completing the triumvirate by going to West Brom, which is very close to Villa Park. When you go to Birmingham, West Brom is very much in the centre of Birmingham. But, he would be much caricatured today, because he just had this way of speaking, and win or lose, it was always grim for Ron Saunders. But there are many ways in which older men can inspire young men, and he certainly inspired this team. And unlike his own image of sort of grim utilitarian functionality, this was a team that was brimming with flair. And anybody who watches a brilliant documentary which covers, it's on YouTube, it covers it, well, it's not that brilliant because it's poorly edited, there's lots of repetition in it, but the best parts are where you see some of this team playing, and they were an exciting team to watch with flair all the way through it. And you know, Ron Saunders, from that that grim exterior, produced something of beauty, which, like many things of beauty, it flared for just a short time, two seasons in this case, before it then disappeared back into the mulch of much of 80s English football.
One of the greatest joys of actually doing, well, many joys of this podcast, one of this one in particular, was discovering this team. Because we do a lot of stuff that we remember, but I was five in 1981, so I don't remember anything, really. So so actually watching this team, because they are a kind of sleeper of English footballing triumph. People don't talk about them that much, especially when you talk about this, that dominant period of that golden period of England, of English football in Europe in particular, 75 to 85, if you like. These aren't really talked about much, and they're not eulogised as much, and there's been nowhere near as many kind of big think pieces about the greatness of them written. So they've never been somebody I'll hold my hand up and say I've paid much attention to, but one of the great joys of going back and looking at this team was I just kept going, bloody hell, the whole time I was watching. I know the highlights reels are what they are, but even so, really, really good way of playing. And there's a discussion we probably will have as we're going through about the role Ron Saunders played in that, because the players don't talk much about the kind of tactical approach he had, if he even had one. And yet they produce this like wonderful, fast-paced attacking football. Have you got any thoughts, Mike, on the team generally, or do you want to talk about the team now?
Yeah, I mean, Gary said earlier, you know, they used 14 players. I would just like to underline that and put some exclamation marks next to it. It's just extraordinary. And I think that's a joint record for winning the Football League or the Premier League. I mean, now every Premier League team uses 14 players in every game, pretty much, you know, because you're allowed three substitutions. Also, I think there were 7 of the players played in every single game. And this is a 42-game season, so it's a 22-team league. To put that in some kind of perspective, Serie A at the time was a 16-team league, so they were only playing 30 league matches a year. I think La Liga in Spain was an 18-team league, so they were doing 34. Those two leagues only had one cup competition. You know, they had two in England, and the League Cup was early rounds played over two legs, so... Yeah, people mythologise and romanticise what a treadmill the old English season was, but it bears repeating, I think. I mean, it's an extraordinary feat to get through an entire season with so few players. And I'm just looking now, they only made 8 substitutions in the whole season, and that would just be someone coming off because they were injured. It's
and they weren't a low-energy team, were they?
No,
Liverpool, to some extent, were a low-energy team, weren't they?
But
play with this team weren't.
Yeah, very high octane, this Villa team. And you're right. They don't talk often about kind of the tactics used. I mean, to me, it looks like standard 4-4-2. And what they talk about outfield players, you play in 5 different combinations, don't you? So you've got the 2 centre halves, you've got the right back and the right wing, you've got the left back and the left wing, the 2 central midfielders, and the 2 centre forwards. So you've just got 5 pairs of players working in tandem, and they all stitch together during the game. So I mean, to me, it looks as straightforward as that. And I think you're right about them not being eulogised enough. I mean, Ron Saunders is not Brian Clough, is he? And, you know, so he doesn't kind of carry that charisma. But, I mean, and we're going to go through the players now. There aren't those kind of... they had some great players, obviously, and we will come on to that. But I don't think there was any one particularly where you could hang this championship on him and say, well, he's the reason that happened. You know, like you've got to say, like, say Shearer for Blackburn, where I don't think one player made such an obvious difference to the rest. I don't think. I don't know what you guys think.
Well, I want to talk about a structural matter that I'm sure I'll be castigated later on Twitter at GaryNaylor999 if you want to tell me just how wrong I am.
Is this one of your sports science theories, Gary? Go on. Yeah. We love this. Go on.
Well, in the 80s in particular, 70s and 80s in particular, the press were a very big player in sports, in football in particular. And there weren't many of them. There was, you know, Ken McGee or Frank McGee, the voice of sport, and there was a guy called Ken who wrote at the Daily Mirror. I think Frank McGee was at the Daily Mirror. And there were other journalists, but, there was no internet. There was BBC and ITV, but they didn't really do a huge amount in the way of journalism. There weren't co-commentators. The personalities in the broadcast media tended to be, Jimmy Hill, obviously, but it was the commentators. It was Coleman, it was Barry Davies, it was John Motson, it was Brian Moore, Hugh Jones in the Midlands for ITV. But it was a relatively small coterie of journalists who were based in London and Manchester. And I really believe this, that they weren't very happy about Villa muscling in on their territory, because all of their contacts were in London and in Manchester. And even I can remember, we took the Daily Mirror delivered, and I can remember even as a quite young, 11 or 12, 13, 14 years old, I'd pick up the Daily Mirror in the morning from behind the door, and the back page was full of Manchester United news. And this was when Liverpool were the European champions, because the contacts were there. And I don't think they had much in the way of contacts. Ron Saunders was taciturn at best. And the media darlings at that time were Ipswich. Now, you may say, well, you know, Ipswich, that's, you know, sort of fairly provincial and everything else. But they had Bobby Robson, of course, who was always great for a quote. And they played the kind of football that, again, it's maybe it's a prejudice of mine, but there's a long-standing, I think, prejudice against high-powered, fast football in England. You were always told you were a technician and you needed to put your foot on the ball and pass. And, you know, I'm not going against Frank Tyson and Arnold Murren, who were outstanding players at Ipswich, and Murren went on to be an outstanding player at Manchester United. But quite a lot of us who were unversed in the arts of football quite liked it when you had midfielders breaking from the halfway line on a muddy pitch, somehow managing to run with the ball, control it and slide it past a goalkeeper advancing to the edge of the box. But somehow we were always told you were a better player if you put your foot on it and passed it sideways and slowed the game down. So you get Tony Curry being eulogised. You get, and I know Mike and I have had a little bit of a conversation about this, you get Ray Wilkins slowing the game down, getting 80-odd caps for England, where Dennis Mortimer speeds the game up and gets precisely zero caps for England. And I just think there was something in that. There was an agenda that was set by where it was easier and where you got better stories, I think, for the press at the time, which was coming out of Manchester and London and Scribe's nightclub and the haunts around Fleet Street and the conversations that would go on. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's always been the case for journalism. But they didn't really want to write about Villa. They didn't want to write about Ron Saunders, you know, and who the hell is Alan Evans? And, you know, Peter Worthy's been around. He's just a big yard dog up front, nodding the ball in the six-yard box. They really looked down on this Villa side. And yet this Villa side, in some ways, were it wasn't so much a kind of high press, but it was heavy metal football from, you know, the city of heavy metal music.
Very good.
You know, it was something that the press never really came to terms with. And even today, as you say, you might get a little bit of appreciation for Gordon Cowans, but you'll go a long way before you get to a list of great English forwards of the 1980s before Gary Shaw's name gets mentioned. And that's because his career was cut short. But Gary Shaw was actually one of the great forwards of the 80s in English forwards of the 80s. He could have gone on to be an all-time great. He really was that good. But you won't read about that in the mainstream media because, you know, he played in Birmingham.
That's one of the fascinating things about this team, actually, is a lot of the credit for putting this team together goes to it's Tony Barton, who's the manager who takes over after Ron Saunders. He was the assistant manager and chief scout at the club. So he would have identified a lot of these players. So on the face of it, it looks like a bit of a patchwork quilt of a team. You know, so you've got Gary Shaw and Gordon Cowans that are coming out of the youth team. Des Bremner and Alan Evans that are signed, you know, from Scotland. Alan Evans, they signed him as a centre forward, actually.
Yeah.
Go on, Mike, finish that point. I'll come in.
Oh, sorry, yeah. And then converted him into a centre half. You had Jimmy Rimmer, who'd been Arsenal's goalkeeper for a long time, and, you know, Peter Wyth, who'd won the championship with Forest. But they're kind of stalwart, good, solid, English league players. So it's a real hybrid of all these things. And I think the Moneyball point you made earlier, Lee, was a good one. You know, it wasn't put together with a tremendous amount of money. And this is even after Andy Gray was sold as well, which I think is like a real big moment in the transformation in this team. So early in the 79-80 season, Andy Gray, who a couple of years earlier had come down from Dundee United and he'd won the Player of the Year award and the Young Player of the Year award in the same season. You know, he was absolutely brilliant in his first couple of years for Villa, Andy Gray, but, you know, fell out with Ron Saunders all the time. There was a big kind of power struggle between the two. Andy Gray actually said that when he left the club, I remember hearing this in an interview with him once, that the board at Villa actually asked him, would you stay if we let the manager go? That's something Andy Gray's claimed. I don't know the veracity of that story, but that's definitely something he said. But he left. He went to Wolves for a British record transfer fee. I think it was just under £1.5 million, which in 1979, that's a colossal sum of money. And, you know, at the point he was sold, it looked, you know, madness to sell, you know, one of the best strikers in England like that. But what it did is it allowed some money to be, not all of it by any means, but some of the money got invested back in the club. They bought Tony Morley from Burnley, and I think that was, you know, quite transformative. And, gradually put together the team that would go on to have this amazing season.
That point about Alan Evans. Sorry, go on, Guy.
I was just going to chip in briefly because Mike makes a point that Alan Evans was a converted forward who went to centre-half, and he could finish. You know, he scored, I think, 7 goals in this season from centre-half, and they weren't from set plays. They were often
from open
play.
He scores an amazing volley on the turn against Birmingham.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Brilliant goal.
Another much underrated forward who would absolutely play in today's football was the fullback Kenny Swain, and he was a converted forward as well. I mean, all of these players were ball players. They were playing on the most dreadful pitches, sometimes with, you know, heavy rain-sodden balls and all of this kind of stuff. But every man from 1 to 11 in that side, well, maybe not one, because, you know, ball-playing goalkeepers were still 20, 30 years in the future. But every one of them was a ball player, and that made a difference. And I'm sure that was part of what Tony Barton was looking for when he was scouting these players. You had to be able to give a pass and take a pass, to play on the half turn, to find a killer ball when the opportunity presented itself. And, you know, you add that to the energy which this team brought, and you've got a formula there that is going to work in any period of football from its founding to the present day.
That Alan Evans point, it's amazing how many times you hear that story in the 70s, 80s, even into the 90s, that yeah, I used to be a striker, but now I'm a centre back or the other way round. Can you imagine that now? Imagine what Twitter would say if somebody who plays as a striker gets moved to centre back. They think everyone had gone insane. But there is something interesting about how were they so interchangeable? I suppose they all make the same runs, don't they? I suppose it's as simple as that.
Well, it's just, I guess it's basically, you stand in the same spot, but just turn around and face the other way, you know, and keep doing what you're doing. But, you know,
they tend to be pacey, don't they? That's true. They both tend to have pace, don't they, if in the truest sense.
Yeah. I mean, in the 90s, I remember Paul Warhurst doing that for Wednesday. Yeah. Chris Sutton, you know, Norwich was...
Warhurst was a fullback at Oldham as well.
Yeah. Ian Marshall, who did he play for?
Ian Marshall left Everton because they wouldn't put him at striker.
Yeah. I'm amazed there aren't more of them, really. What tends to happen is that they start as strikers, as Alan Evans did, and they just don't quite have that pace. But if they can read the game, you can drop back, have the game in front of you rather than play back to goal, and then be able to just have that little yard extra to play in. Was the last of them Dion Dublin? Dion Dublin would sometimes play centre-half one day and centre-forward the next. But it happens less frequently. I think there's something amiss in football. I think there are players who are playing in the wrong places. Mason Holgate, we all think, is a defensive central midfield player who somehow is at full-back and centre-half for Everton. And Steven Gerrard started out as a fullback who went into midfield. And, you know, there's a lot of Liverpool fans, I think that Trent Alexander-Arnold should be playing more as a midfielder, particularly now as teams are targeting him as a weak link defensively. But players do get assigned positions, sometimes I suspect in schoolboy football, and, you know, they stay with that for 30 years as a career, from the under 10s through to their last games at 37 and 38. And I think there should be more imagination shown, and I think this Villa side showed a benefit of that imagination with a fullback who could play like a winger and a forward in Kenny Swain, and a centre half who could finish like a centre forward in Alan Evans.
So it's probably worth, we've talked about some of the players there. It's probably just worthwhile just running through kind of those 14 players. We've mentioned Jimmy Rimmer, the goalkeeper signed from Arsenal, had one England cap on a ridiculous tour to the USA in the late 70s. But, you know, that England was quite, it had the reputation for being strong for keepers for a long time. And I think he was kind of proof of it, really. I suppose they were about three ahead of him for England, if you look at it that way. Kenny Swain, we've already mentioned, who was signed as a midfielder but became a fullback, put in at fullback. And I think you're absolutely right, Gary. They could all play the ball very, very well. And that screams out when you watch the footage now, just how well they could play. And I think there is something about that's what they were looking for ultimately. Colin Gibson was a left back. He was only 21 years old, England under 21 international. Went to United later on, Mike, as I'm sure you will recall. Gary Williams, the fullback, who was only 20 years old. Ken McNaught, Scottish central defender, joined Villa from Everton in 77. Was of the classical school of stopper, Gary, I think you would say.
Oh, yeah. He was a big Scottish stopper, blonde-haired. He was very much sort of in the Gordon McQueen mould. What you saw is what you got from Ken McNaught. He'd give you a reducer or a reminder, but you didn't want anybody else when that corner or set piece is dropping between the six-yard box and the penalty spot. You didn't want any other player in English football getting his head on it than Ken McNaught, because he would clear that ball, and if you were in the way, he'd clear you as well.
Alan Evans, the other Scottish centre-half that we've talked about. Of course, the other converted Scottish centre-forward we forgot about was Kenny Burns, of course. Forest, who everyone thought Clough was insane. Gordon Cowans, we've mentioned Sid Cowans. He was known to probably the biggest Villa legend now in this day and age. Recently diagnosed with dementia, Gordon Cowans, last year, unfortunately for him. But Mike, you're quite a fan of Gordon Cowans, aren't you?
Yeah, oh God, great player, yeah. And yeah, you can see it right through this season. Brilliant. you know, passing range, great vision, would join attacks. We'd do the full midfield remit as well, I think. Along with Dennis Mortimer, actually, and they just seem to have a great understanding between them of, like, you know, who should go, who should stay. You know, this thing that Frank Lampard and Steven Gerrard never quite got their
it
got
always
their
comes
heads
back
or,
to them too, doesn't it? It
yeah, their heads or their egos around sorting out. But yeah, and I think that's the thing. Actually, there's a real kind of lack of ego in this team, I think. Or it
that's
seems
a
to
really
me,
good
anyway.
Point, actually. Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I've briefly forgotten the winger's name now.
Tony Moore.
He was the one who was seen as a bit flash because he had slightly longer hair than the rest of the rest of the team. But yeah, they were very all in and, you know, running hard and running for each other, I think. But yeah, Cowens, the vision of him, it's you get the impression where some people, they talk about the 80s now, particularly if they hadn't seen it. Well, you know, Glenn Hoddle was the only English player that could get the ball down and spray it around, and everyone else was like a lumbering pit pony playing midfield. But it wasn't true. And Dennis Mortimer as well, I think, was a fantastic player. You know, breaking late through midfield. There's a couple of his goals from this season where, you know, Villa break up the pitch and he arrives late in the box or through the middle. To get on the end of something. But Cowan's good enough to later be picked up by Bari and go to Serie A. He's one of the few players in this team that would get international honours. I mean, he was so good. I think he just kind of eventually forced the issue on that. And it's a real shame with him, actually. In 83, I think he broke his leg and missed an entire season when he was never quite the same player again. But for the few years we're going to talk about here, the Championship and the European Cup, yeah, he was absolutely integral to everything they did.
On 22 this year, just down the youth setup, basically.
Yeah, I mean, he was a little like, in the present day, a kind of Luka Modric-type figure. It was out Gordon Cowans, Luka Modric. You look at the playing honours, Cowans, he won the League Cup, he won Division 1, the title, he won the Charity Shield, he won the European Cup and the European Super Cup. And that's a palmares to set alongside any there. And he certainly had that sort of slight fragility that you'd see in a Luka Modric or maybe a Pavel Nedved or someone like this. He wasn't a big man. He was slight of frame as well as relatively short of stature. But he could hold his own. But he could get on the ball and then he could see a pass and then give a pass. And he never shirked a challenge. In this day and age, in the early 80s, you'd be kicked up in the air over and over again, and Cowans, with his rolled down socks, would just get back up again, take the free kick, drop it on the head of Peter Withe, who'd nod it into the back of the net 1-0.
I think he disproves the theory about English midfield play in those days, you know, that you had to be, you know, brawny and hard working, and you couldn't survive otherwise in this, you know, great threshing machine in the middle of the park. And he was a very spindly guy.
Yeah, he's fairly willowy, wasn't he? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the shirts. Could they not have got a shirt that fitted him at all? I mean, it's like the sleeves are coming over his hands, it seems to me, like all the time. It's just clinging to him when it's wet. And it's
there's just a touch of Billy Casper in Cass about there always was. But yeah, I mean, I think if he played for Tottenham and Hoddle had played for Villa, I think we pretty much have the same thing in reverse. I really do.
To be honest, yeah, I do see what you're saying, Gary. I do. We move on to, you've already mentioned him, but I think Dennis Mortimer, who for me was the greatest, because I was 5 at the time, looking back at it, was the greatest revelation watching this, because what a player. Lovely. Late, like you said, Gary, Mike, late running, involved in everything, the tempo, lovely diagonally angled passes along the floor and everything. Oh, just such a nice player. Signed from Coventry in 1975, ran around with his shirt out, looking a bit like Ricky Villa, but nowhere near as exotic. Great.
He was just everything I want in a midfield player. He was a scouser to boot. There was a strong Scouse spine to this team with Mortimer Morley out wide and Peter Withe through the middle. And he never lost his...
And Saunders, of course, from Birkenhead.
Ron Saunders,
well, you wouldn't think so, hearing him speak, would you, that Ron Saunders
was from
Birkenhead?
No, there was just a little bit of Birkenhead in there, yeah. And, you know, that's partly why there's definitely an affinity between Villa fans and Everton fans due to, you know, many shared histories and a certain sense of similar records in lots of ways. But it was cemented, I think, and forever will be in this... early 80s team, because, you know, Dennis Mortimer was just a fantastic player. He was a kind of player I really like as well, because he was a hard man, but he wasn't a hard man because he booted you up in the air. He was a hard man because when he was booted up in the air, he got back on his feet and got on with the game. But a brilliant runner from midfield, a leader, box to box, goal scorer, inspirer of his teammates. What more do you want? Well, people obviously did want more because he got precisely zero England caps, which is a travesty of the highest order.
Yeah, he's one of the first players signed by Saunders as well, actually. I think he came,
75,
came in 75. Yeah. He's the captain of the team as well. And I think, yeah, definitely in that conversation of the greatest players never to be capped by England, you know, he'd be in there with Steve Bruce and is it Howard Kendall? That's the Everton one, isn't it, Gary? It never got.
He was the one of the Holy Trinity. Didn't get a cap. I think Colin Harvey only got one or two, but I don't think Kendall got an England cap. Yeah. But
Mortimer
held up the European Cup. He lifted the European Cup. I think probably Steve Bruce did as well, to be fair. But to lift the European Cup and not get a cap playing on some gridiron field on some USA tour in order to promote some FIFA bid or something. It's just unbelievable.
Moving on, Des Bremner. We'll come back to that, no doubt, when we talk about some performances, especially the European season. So Des Bremner signed from Hibs in 79. He wasn't the only cap once by Scotland, but it, you know, that period was pretty strong in Scotland. Peter Withe, you've already mentioned.
Do you want to say a few words about Des Bremner? Because he was very much the workhorse in this team. And Mortimer was more box-to-box, but he was more ahead of the game. He was the runner onto the end of the passes, where Bremner tended to sit deeper. And there's a lovely bit where he's talking about one of his goals in that documentary where he's very self-deprecating about his finishing. But it was a time when you know, a sitting midfielder really did sit and they didn't often go forward. But he read the game so well. He was quite an experienced pro at this time. I think he was 28 or so at the time. And I think some of his approach to the game is shown in his subsequent career, where I think he became the chief financial officer of the PFA or something. You know, this is a man who knew how to allocate his resources, physical and mental, particularly well. And it showed in that side. You know, every great team has a player who is kind of underrated or whom, you know, you don't really see. And that player in this team was Des Bremner. And you, at that time, you always had to remind yourself that this was not Billy Bremner, because Bremner, the name, was so associated with Billy Bremner. And you get the idea that that one or two Scottish caps that he got, perhaps they did think he was Billy Bremner in the way that Mike Bassett picked Benson and Hedges. But he very much deserved that Scotland cap. And how many caps would he have had in the last 10 years for Scotland? 100? But that just goes, as you've already said, Lee, as a testament to the talent that was available to Scottish managers at the time.
Peter Withe's up front. We've already mentioned him a little bit. He'd been signed from Forest in 78 after Clough decided that wasn't it. I think it was coincided with Tony Woodcock coming through was when Withe was let go, from memory, but I could be wrong. And
Birtles,
of course, yeah. So, but like you said, I mean, much travelled and frequently underrated, it says here, which I think is probably sums it up, really, doesn't it? And yet bagged a shitload of goals this season, and was a perfect foil for, well, the perfect partnership with him and Gary Shaw.
Yeah, he was a real penalty box bully. He would get on the end of crosses, scored a lot of goals from inside the six-yard box. Very much knew his game. He knew a centre-halves game. He knew where the referees were looking and when they were looking in those places. And he brought all that old pro experience to score vital goals in vital games. And a connoisseur's choice, I think. When you watched Peter Withe, you watched as much for the kind of dark arts and, you know, almost the runs he didn't make. He was one of those players who, if he stood still, found himself in space. And you know, he was a centre forward who absolutely maxed out his abilities. And again, I think that's a testament to the players who were around him, but also to the coaching and to Ron Saunders' ability to knit together a jigsaw of players, which any one of those pieces mislaid. And I think this team is weakened significantly. But all of them came together and they all played, well, seven of them played every match. So that possibility didn't arise. But yeah, I mean, there's always going to be a place for someone who gets on the end of crosses, who can finish with either foot and who can bully a centre half, and that's what Peter Withe did.
So why has there been no like loads of think pieces on, you know, Peter Withe being the Serginho of this team?
Well,
which again just shows you nobody pays any attention to this team, do they? Because they probably wouldn't even know who the stars were, really.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you ask a lot of football fans of today, you know, who scored a goal to win a European Cup final for a British club, you'll get a lot of names before you get to Peter Withe.
That's very true. Speaking about a lack of superstars in this team, I suppose if there was to be nominations for the actual standout stars of the team, you're into the kind of last that it will come from one of these last two players, which is Gary Shaw that our Gary has already eulogised on what a wonderful player he was. And then, of course, Tony Morley, 26-year-old winger signed from Burnley. For somebody who was seen as a bit flash, Mike, as you said before, yet when you hear him speak, very, very unassuming, humble sort of guy, completely opposite to kind of how he played, perhaps.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, what a brilliant player. And this season as well, I mean, he's got so many standout, I guess, moments in it. And from when they won the European Cup as well. I mean, for 2 years, I can't believe there would have been many better players than him anywhere in the Football League. Really. He's their John Robertson, really, you know, if you want to kind of hold them up to Forrest for a comparison. He was just, you know, this game breaker, and a bit like, you know, we discussed with Kinchelsis earlier, I think a bit ahead of his time, you know, a right-footed winger playing on the left, who could cut in and shoot.
His left foot was great as well, though, wasn't it?
Oh, God, his crossing, yeah, from his left foot. It was, you know, fantastic. He's such a threat, you know, could stand a fullback up and then, you know, from a standing start, go past him. And just the perfect outlet for this team on the left, really. You know, brilliant, brilliant players. I read an interview with him actually where he said he lost a lot of faith in English football, just generally as a thing, when he didn't get taken to the 1982 World Cup. Which,
well, you know, would, wouldn't you?
Christ, well, yeah, you just think, well, how much better can I play?
What am
not,
I supposed to do exactly? Yeah,
you know, and you're taking 200 players in Keegan and Brooking, but you know, you're leaving me at home, and after all I've done, I really can't blame him for that. But came across from Burnley in '79, and Burnley's, I suppose, around then had a great reputation as being an academy for really talented wingers. Basically, Trevor Stephen came out of Burnley as well, and signed for Everton. But
he was good, was he, Gary?
No, there was Dave Thomas, I think Leighton James as well.
Yeah, but fantastic player. Would go on to score the goal of the season in this campaign at Goodison Park, with a young Gary Naylor looking on, awestruck.
We'll come to later on, no doubt. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, I think I said earlier you wouldn't necessarily pluck one player out and say they were the difference in this season. but he was one of the ones, certainly, just kind of bubbled up to slightly above the rest in terms of, you know, he was a real game-breaking player for Villa.
Yeah, he was such an exciting player to watch, Tony Morley. He had a bit of John Robertson about him, but he was quicker over sort of 40 yards than Robertson. Because once Morley went past you, that was it. You know, he was going to get his cross in. He was going to get his shot in, as he did at Goodison for the goal of the season there. And I remember the reaction. There was a kind of 2-minute hush where we worked out what had happened, because it was very early in the game. I think it was 3 minutes into the game. And then applause went around the ground. There was no kind of booing, or it was just an acknowledgement that we'd seen a great goal, with the ball moving from Everton's dead ball or Villa's dead ball line in three passes into the back of the net. I mean, it helped that he was a scout. He was an Evertonian. Lots of his family were there watching, and there was an interesting tale of how he'd been wound up by Ron Saunders, which I think shows a little bit of Saunders' dry sense of humour, where he'd said he'd given the reserve team bibs out to them in training the day before they were playing the match. And Morley was a bit miffed about this. And he went to Ron Saunders, says, "What's going on?" Ron Saunders apparently said, "Well, you know, it's a big game for you, and I'm not sure your head's in the right place, so I'm going to, you know, put Pat Hurd in there. He's a bit more reliable than yourself." And, you know, Morley was full of anger and everything else, saying, "I've got my mum and dad coming," and all of this kind of stuff. And then the morning of the match, Ron Saunders goes to him and said, "I've had a bit of a rethink, so get yourself ready. You're in the 11. And sure enough, he did go in the 11, and 3 minutes in, he scores the goal, and he doesn't quite give the V sign to the bench, but he gives it a bit of an up yours to Ron Saunders in doing that. But of course, Saunders had pulled the trick, and he got that out of Tony Morley. But, you know, everything you want from a wide player, as you say, a game changer, cross off either foot, nightmare to defend against. God knows what it'd be like these days with yellow cards and VAR and stuff like this. Because once he got past you, that was it. But somehow not good enough for England, except on, I think, eight occasions. Extraordinary stuff. But I just want to say a few words about Gary Shaw as well, because I've already said how good he was. An absolutely tremendous player. Played 40 matches. I think he was 20 years old, was he, or 21? At this time, it was his first full season. Scored 18 goals, and the quality of the goals that he scored were absolutely outstanding. He could do everything. Hold the ball up back to goal, play whilst being kicked, lovely linking play. He could get on the end of crosses. He could run and shoot from the edge of the box. He scored scrappy goals as well. A bad injury at the age of 23. He did play after that, but he never really came back to the heights that he hit. But he could have been that great centre forward. He was, in some ways, he was like Trevor Francis. At the same age, Trevor Francis was a prodigy and a Birmingham lad himself. Gary Shaw had absolutely everything. You could always spot him as well, because he had a boy band mop of blonde hair, which always helped in those days in picking out players when you couldn't see numbers on shirts and things like this. There were no names on shirts. And you know, what would Gary Shaw be worth after a 18 goal season like that, and winning the title at 20 years old today as an English player? You're looking 60 million and the rest, aren't you? What a player, and what a personal tragedy as well as a tragedy for English football, if we can use that word, that he never had the opportunity to explore his potential. I do think when I look at English players, his ceiling was at least as high as Trevor Francis's ceiling, and possibly higher. Who knows what he would have gone on to achieve, but the evidence that we have across a whole season and then a European Cup campaign is that the sky was the limit for Gary Shaw. But alas, we never got to see it. But what a player.
Yeah, he's one of the great lost talents of English football, I think. I mean, it's so sad that his career got curtailed by injury like this. So he was 19 years old when this season kicked off, you know, straight out of the Villa Academy. And I think there's something magical at any club, isn't there, of what if you... I mean, bringing through your own players is great, but if you bring through a striker, you know, the kid that scores you the goals, that wins the game. It's like, you know, like with when you know, Robbie Fowler came through at Liverpool, Harry Kane now.
Wait, Rooney just, at Everton.
Yeah, Rooney at Everton. It just means so much more, doesn't it, I think.
Yeah.
And we kind of romanticised a little bit earlier about, you know, the fact that this team played such an amount of football, you know, with so few players. They never changed the team. So when he did get injured in, it's in September of 83, it's in a tackle with Ian Bowyer in a game against Forest, and his knee goes, basically. I mean, that might have been a one-off impact injury, obviously, but I do wonder about the effect of a young player like that playing so much football in those conditions and, you know, playing all the time as well. It's like, what impact that has on your body, you know, does it weaken you? Does it leave you more susceptible to picking up, you know, a really bad injury that can affect your career? Because Gary Shaw, the sadness of it is, really, Gary Shaw, he could and should have been one of the players of the 80s, really. I mean, you may not even have heard of Gary Lineker in terms of, you know, what he went on to be in terms of, you know, scoring 48 for England and being the golden boot winner at the 86 World Cup and all of that. I mean, that could have been Gary Shaw, you know, doing all of that for England. And well, we should be thankful, really. I think we saw him, one, this season. I mean, the point you make, the variety of goals he scores, left foot, right foot, you know, from distance, that calmness of a bomb disposal expert when he's in the area, and the amount of goals he's involved in that he doesn't score as well, you know, assists and or pre-assists and all these kind of terms people bandy about now. Yeah, what a sensational player. And we would go on to be the young player of the year this season as well. And it's great that we got to see him, you know, win the title and win the European Cup. It's tinged with just a little bit of sadness if you think, well, what a player he could have been if he could have got to, you know, his mid to late 20s with a, you know, in full health.
Yeah, absolutely. So we've probably reached the end of part one now. I'll just finish quickly. We've said about the players that played every game. It's just worthwhile listing who they are. It was Des Bremner, Gordon Cowans, Ken McNaught, Ken Swain, Tony Morley, Dennis Mortimer, and Jimmy Rimmer all played every single game. So it's just, you know, which is, and then a number of others played 39 and 40 and 36. It was a ridiculous season in many ways. That's given us a count. Yeah, go on, Mike.
Sorry, can I just say quickly? I think earlier on I called Tony Morley Tony Mortimer. Tony Morley and Dennis Mortimer were not in East 17. I'll just clarify that.
We did wish that Gary Shaw would stay another day, don't we?
Yes.
Oh,
come on, now. Seamless, now we really do need seamless. To end. So that brings us to the end of part one. We will go into detail about the season itself. We've gone through the team in some detail, which was really, really good. We'll talk about the season itself and the subsequent European season and all the shenanigans with Ron Saunders in part two. Take care, everybody, and we'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18+.